Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2630. That's 2630. Tonight we're going to have a special guest. Her name is Dr. Teresa Van Wooy, and she's from Benicia, California, and she is a survivor of physical, emotional, and neglectful child abuse, absolutely, along with 8 siblings. So she was one of 8, I guess. Yeah, one of 8 siblings. At the hands of their mother. The mother was the one that was the abuser, and she has quite a bio here, and I don't like, going into the bio, okay? I allow for the person to, tell the story, and then when we do have a panel, I see that Bill from California, he is our founder, he has called in. The number here, by the way, is 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118, okay? What we do is we, if we have a panel, we allow for the panel to ask questions. And we do that 2 or 3 times. Do you mind if I call you Teresa? Is that all right?
Oh, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. When people call in, we allow for them to ask questions and so forth. And we do it about 2, maybe 3 times throughout the show. Now, this gives more understanding a lot of times. A lot of times people have questions, and, it's just good for them to get it out, and it makes the show very lively, too. Okay, but first of all, I want to read the mission statement, okay? And that's NASCA. This is our NASCA mission statement. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so in 2 different ways. Number 1 is educating the public, especially as relating to getting a society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, and it is a worldwide problem, and it does affect everyone. Number 2 is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay. So what we do on this show is we're always trying to educate the public one way or another. And to educate the public, this is a really good thing, so that if they see child abuse and they get to know what the signs and symptoms are, many times they can call for help, and this can help a child. It can save a child, all right? So this is one of the many, many, many things we do on NASCA. And what I just read, too, is only a small part of NASCA. I think it's a good idea that people get really involved and get knowledgeable about our website, and that's NASCA.org, NASCA.org. When you do this, okay, when you become knowledgeable and you need things to look up, information you want to try and get, I've taken much information from our website. You go down to the red lines and you click on to prevention, say, or intervention, or whatever you want to, and a menu drops down. And there's a lot of good information that you can click on to, and it teaches you about child abuse, okay? We've had many people that have come on the show who have given us information, and we put this website together. And I'm pretty proud of it because I use it a lot. I'm glad we have it. Now we have two more callers that called in. And so we have, let's see, myself, and I think this is Pamela, and we have you, the guest, and we have Bill from California, and the 931, that might be Darlene, but I'm not too sure. Bill, maybe you can look that up. I see you there. I could see who it is myself. Hold on a second.
Hello.
Who is this?
Hello,
931?
Darlene.
That's what
okay,
I said. Oh my God, I was right. Okay, we have. I know. I'll get it straight someday. Yes, I promise. I'm gonna put your number up on the wall in big red letters in front of me. So okay. But anyway, oh, I'm so happy she's here, and she is actually an ambassador, and we have a lot of ambassadors, and we hope that the ambassadors start calling in, you know, once a month. That would be a good thing to do. All right. So let's get started, though. We have a nice enough, you know, amount of people here where we can have a good show, and we're going to have a good show. And, again, for those who haven't listened or heard before, and there's a lot of people listening through the computer rather than coming on the show, that's okay. They need to listen. It says, tonight's special guest is Dr. Teresa Van Wooy from Benicia, California. She is a survivor of physical, emotional, and neglectful child abuse, along with 8 siblings at the hands of the mother. Now, that's all I'm going to say of her bio, but she does have quite a bio here. So in a little while, I'll bring on the panel and let them introduce themselves, and then we'll continue back on to your story. So when I ask you to stop for a second or two, Teresa, remember where you dropped off. Remember what you were saying, okay? And then you can go right back to where you were. That makes it easy for you. That makes it easy for me. That sounds good to me. Okay. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us how this all started. Go ahead.
How the abuse started, you mean?
Yeah, it says the physical, emotional, neglectful abuse. Tell us what happened.
Okay.
Tell us about your family.
Well,
go ahead.
So basically when my mother was pregnant with me, I'm the 7th of 9 kids, she shut herself off in her room, had the lights off, the curtains closed, and just stayed in darkness during her pregnancy. And eventually she was admitted and was going to the psych ward at the hospital. While she was still pregnant with me, and the doctor said she had a nervous breakdown is what they said, and they put her on some pills even while she was pregnant. And then when I was born, you know, my mom was severely depressed, and basically my older sister took care of me, most of my older siblings, but I guess my older sister mostly gave me baths and fed me and everything. And then fast forward 7 years, my mom showed it up at our house in a camper to take us on a family vacation for the summer, leaving my dad behind. And so she piled all 9 of us kids in the camper, and we took off. We didn't have any idea where we were going, and we ran out of food stamps and ran out of money, and we were digging in garbage cans and begging. My brother and I were 2 of the youngest. We were begging in the back doors of restaurants for food. And then we made it to San Francisco. So in San Francisco, we were in the camper, and we were basically going from park to park, living in this tiny camper, and getting kicked out left and right by the cops and having to move. And finally, one of the officers told us about this homeless shelter for families called Raphael House. So that's where we stayed. They took my mom and all 9 of us kids in. And then while we were staying there for a few weeks, my mom sent half of my siblings back home to Florida to be with my dad and kept the others with her. Well, my mom has always had a way of dividing the kids. She had her favorites, and then she had the ones that she didn't like so much. And it went solely by the way we looked. If we looked like her or her side of the family, then you're a favorite. And if we looked like my dad, she basically couldn't stand us. And so the ones that she kept in San Francisco with her was my oldest sister, who's 5 years older than me, who's her absolute favorite of the bunch. And then she kept me, and she kept my twin brothers, who are 5 years younger than me. And she said she kept us. Well, she kept Rachel because she's the favorite. And then she kept the three youngest because we'd be around the longest to take care of her. So from the homeless shelter, my mom finally found us a studio apartment for the five of us in the Tenderloin District, which is basically the slums of San Francisco with drug dealers and prostitutes and all that. And all of a sudden, I became in charge of everything, of the grocery shopping, the cleaning, the cooking, taking care of my little brothers. And I started third grade in San Francisco, and, you know, basically she, after riding the bus, the city bus to school a couple times with my sister, she then says, okay, you're on your own. And I had never taken the bus home before because my mother would, I would meet her at a park, her and the twins, and she'd take me home in the camper. So now all of a sudden I'm on my own to go home on the bus. And I remembered, you know, the bus stop where I got off that morning. And I'm like, you know, all day in school, I was so scared I wouldn't remember and or the name of the bus. And I went down to the bus stop right where I got off. And I saw the bus, 19 Polk is what she said, take the 19 Polk. And I got on the bus and I asked the driver, and like, do you go to 19 Polk? And he's like, well, this is the 19 Polk. Where do you want to go? Well, I didn't know my address. I didn't have a phone number. We didn't have a telephone. And it took a cop at the end of the line all day into the night to help me find my way home, just by some landmarks I remembered. My mom, the abuse, you know, she wouldn't let me cut my hair. I always had long hair. And, you know, she would basically drag me around the apartment by my hair, and she'd throw me against the wall. And just for if anything happened, if the dishes weren't done, if there was any arguing at the table while we were eating, whatever the case may be, it was taken out on me. And she would, you know, I guess, you know, her main thing, she would, you know, like dig her fingernails into me, and she'd throw me on the floor and start kicking me and kicking me in the ribs. And so, I mean, the abuse was pretty rampant. It happened all the time. It wasn't just here and there, or every once in a while. It was constant. And trying to tell my story in order. In the summers, the rest of my siblings would come back to visit, and they'd get on a Greyhound bus, and my dad would send them, and then my mom and the camper would take these summer vacations. And, you know, when we were all together, I didn't have the abuse as much because there were others that she also couldn't stand out of the kids. But every summer we'd still be starving and begging for food because there were just so many of us to feed. one summer, she left me and my brother, who's 2 years older than me, when I was 9. She left us, forgot us, in Cherokee, North Carolina. So we were there all day. And, I mean, it's really an amazing story because, I don't know, you know, I guess because we were, you know, running up and down the streets, like looking in all the stores, calling out for my mom and my siblings. The shop owners, you know, knew, and we were panicked because we were back and forth, running to the shops, running back to the parking lot, running to this museum. And so the whole town of Cherokee got together. One second. In one shop, this lady behind the register called us over, and we thought that she thought that we stole something or something like that, and we thought we were in trouble. But she asked us, she's like, hey, can y'all go ask the guy next door in the next shop over if he has the key to Cherokee? I'm looking for the key to Cherokee. And she goes, I'll give you 50 cents if you do that. Hmm. So we're like, yeah, of course, sure. And so we took the 50 cents, so we went next door. And, you know, this guy was like, oh, no, I don't have the key to Cherokee. And, you know, you might want to try over there. And so he gave us 50 cents. And this went on, like, we were all going from shop to shop in Cherokee. And they were giving us 50 cents, a quarter each. And somebody gave us free ice cream cones because they didn't have the key to Cherokee. We got a free ride on the Skylift thing. And, I mean, it was amazing how that town came together for us.
That is beautiful, most of you. Yeah. Well, let me stop you there, okay, honey? We have an hour and a half. We have an hour and a half. So, but before I bring on the panel, I think that's what community is supposed to be about. You know what I'm saying? When they see children, that are in such distress, look what they did, you know. And those people, my God, by the time, at the end of the day, how many 50 cents did you have? I don't know.
Yeah, well, enough to buy some snacks and get some food.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, good. You know, right? That's wonderful. I'm glad that at least for that one day you ate. I used to go around and collect bottles at one point in my life. And I was pregnant with my daughter, and I already had my son. And because my husband was no good. You don't know how to pick good husbands a lot of times. And I remember people showing kindness to me also. You know, I'd go to a bodega, as they call it, in the city of bodegas, and they'd make me a when you're pregnant, you crave something, right? So I would crave grilled cheese and tomato sandwiches. So they would make a big one for me and then chop off a piece for my son so he'd have some too and then give us a free drink. Oh, my God, I look forward to it every day. So, yeah. You know, see, that's what people are supposed to do, okay? That's my point. And in your case, you know, there was a lot of kids, and that was a fine town. Okay, let me bring on Pamela, okay? And she's the ambassador. She's from Louisiana, and she's a board member also. Hold on a second. Pamela, say hi.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm so glad you're here. And
thank you.
So happy that, so happy that you're here for us to support you through your story. I know I can already feel the tears and the love and the for you, you know, welling up in our eyes for you because we love you and we want you to share your story so that you feel better and so that other survivors, you know, that can relate can see that. You know, if you're able to, then they're able to. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that you're not alone. You're not alone. And like Carol just mentioned, our stories, you know, have some similarities. They're not exactly the same. but we all have the same feelings, you know, when we're neglected and treated that way. So did you have any safe place that you would go to find, you know, to just be alone and have your own space? I mean, it might have just been in your mind somewhere, you know, but how did you cope? Yeah.
I had the streets of San Francisco. The city was my playground, and I roamed all around San Francisco. I didn't have a place in the apartment or anything, and I always, you know, I had to do my work around the house, but whenever that was done, I tried my best to be outside somewhere.
Yeah. Was it scary out there alone in the streets of San Francisco at that time?
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely, especially in the Tenderloin. I had been followed so many times and people exposing themselves to me. And, yeah, there were a lot of really scary times. But after we moved from the Tenderloin and different areas, you know, I found like a park or, you know, the ocean or, you know, different places that I could go to.
Yeah, I bet the ocean was soothing, huh?
Yeah.
So how did you think you were ever going to make it through this? What were your thoughts as a child, thinking you're always going to live this way or that it'll stop someday? Or what was your train of thought then?
Well, I went through times where I thought I wouldn't survive and that my mother would kill me. And I used to always imagine that my tears were blood, and I'd wipe my tears and check them, thinking that I'm crying blood because she's finally going to kill me. But I always knew, you know, one day when I'm old enough, I can leave her, and I'm not going to be stuck with her forever. And I also knew I wasn't going to be like her or live like her once I'm out. And I always had that. If she didn't kill me, then I'm going to do something on my own.
Right. Well, I'm probably sure you're going to tell us later that there was something wrong with her mentally, because no mother acts like this, and you know, unless they're unstable or have disorder. So I just want to thank you for telling your story, and I'm with you. So, you know, tell it
thank
the way
you
want to. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that, Pamela. Let's go down to Bill here. Let me open up his mic here. Oh, Bill.
Yeah.
Hi.
Thanks, Carol. Yeah, I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. Teresa, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate this. And I can get a flavor for living in a camper, because I've crisscrossed the country a bunch of times in vehicles that were the size of vans. And, you know, but I also know San Francisco well enough that as soon as you say, you know, Tenderloin District, that's a horrible, you know, place to raise a family. And in that era, it was really, really bad. So
yeah,
I appreciate your being vulnerable and telling us about what happened to you, and looking forward to more. But as Pamela said, you know, I did not grow up in the Tenderloin District, but I certainly had the feelings that you're expressing. And so it's not the facts, it's the feelings behind, you know, our being abused and how it relates to us later as trauma in adulthood that I know I will identify with. In any case, thank you very much, Teresa. Appreciate your being here.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Let's go down to Darlene now. Her mic is open. Okay, Darlene. You're up. Go ahead, hon.
Okay, thank you, Teresa, for coming.
You're welcome.
And I had bought your Kindle version, and I started reading up on it. And it made me remember about when we used to wear the cloth diapers as well, because I didn't have the other kind of diapers available at the time. And I felt sorry, empathy, when your mother didn't care less about you and how she hurt you and knocked you to the floor and kicked you around and everything inside that camper. You wanted to go out with the rest of them, but you were afraid to move. And we had a lot of times we have trouble with that. We're afraid to get to safety because there's a big brick block wall right there that's standing in the way of getting safe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt for her. How old were you when that first time when y'all went to the hotel and, you know, y'all didn't get a room or nothing, but she had y'all to bathe in the swimming pool?
Seven. But okay. When we were taking the trip across country, but every summer that's how we would take our baths pretty much. So, but yeah, the first time was when I was seven.
Oh, okay. I really felt for that lady in a hotel room with your mom treating her that way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, and whatever, they couldn't find your mom and took you to juvie. I was reading that part, too.
Uh-huh.
How was that at that time?
I was seven then, too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's something you can elaborate on a little more so that people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I kind of skipped by all that. Yeah. Okay.
So many things happened to you at the age of seven. I mean, it says here, at the age of seven, I was now in charge of taking care of my mother, my older sister, your mother, much older than you, and my younger twin brothers. My God, how does a seven-year-old even comprehend how to do that? I mean, we grow up so fast, Teresa, and we're struggling within our own brains, you know, how to survive and what to do and to take care of. And that must have been a very, very upsetting time for you in your life, because at the age of seven, you're supposed to be playing with Barbie dolls or something. I don't know. I didn't have any of them either. But I'm just saying, you know, or, you know, that's a terrible thing for someone to have to do at the age of seven. So often our abuse does start at that very, very early age. And by the way, I've been in San Francisco also. We used to go down by Haight Street and down by the hippie area. It was funny. But my husband and I also, my first husband and I also went across, you know, and saw the prison. That's why we actually went there. And that was quite a scene to see that and be a part of that. But I did go up and down in the trolley, you know, up and down San Francisco. So I could see why you could look at that as a place, being that I was there also. It was like a fun place to be, to run around, to watch, to see. Did you ever get on the trolley?
The cable car? Yeah.
Yeah.
I would take it every day.
Yeah,
because my school was right off the cable car line, right where I went to school.
So can I ask you a question about that?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so after you had to go ahead and go back to school and everything, I feel sorry for the kids that was left behind for the fact that she probably abandoned them when you were gone.
The twins? No. She was with them. She basically, the twins were always with her everywhere she went.
There's one of the twins that looked like your daddy, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then she treated him differently because of that too, right?
Yeah,
I did read that right then. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you
so
much.
You see that right there. Darling. That happens in a lot of families. When one's an outcast, it's because there's a reason for it, and it's because that child looks like someone who's not of their family. Let's put it that way, because that's so many
that's
of us go
me.
Through this.
That's me.
And me too. Oh boy, I just found out not too long ago. But anyway, all right, that's enough of that. But anyway, continue on with your story. Yes, we do. Okay. There's so many things here that we're identifying with. See, that's what I was telling you before the show actually started. You can't shock us, and we can't shock you, because a lot of us have been in such similar situations. And I'm so glad that you're going out telling your story, because, you know, here you're right on air. Okay, there's a lot of people that are going to be listening to it, maybe even later on, because we have archives. And it's being recorded right now. So, you know, this helps a lot of people who maybe were displaced or put in different homes or didn't have a home or were out on the streets. They were homeless, you know, things like that, because they don't feel like they're alone anymore. So I thank you so much for coming on this show, because there's many of us at NASCA who didn't have a home or had a home and were thrown out of the home or whatever the case might be. So let's get back to where you were. Darlene, do you remember where that was? Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I will back up a little bit because Darlene reminded me about spending the night in juvie. So on our cross-country trip, we it took a long time to go from Jacksonville to San Francisco. We made a lot of stops. And in Louisiana, we went all over the state visiting relatives and, you know, really, like, took our time. And my mom really, I don't think she had any idea where she wanted to go or where we were going. So we would go to hotel or motel swimming pools and bring our bottle of shampoo in, and that's where we would take our baths in the swimming pool. So we pretty much got kicked out of almost every motel we went to. And in the book, you know, I talk about just one story and my mom splashing the lady and wetting, soaking her. And my mom is a foul mouth to a lot of people. Unless she likes you, then it's a syrupy, sweet, nasty, disgusting voice. They're both pretty bad. There's that. And then when we made it to Las Vegas, my mom brought us to Circus Circus. And in Circus Circus, and so she would stop off. She does prepare ahead of time. She might not have the money to, like, prepare, like, to feed us and take care of us, but she kind of knows. She'll read about things, and she stops at the when we enter each state, she stops at the visitor center and talks to the person. What do we do here? What's the best to see? Where can I take the kids? Stuff like that. So she knew about Circus Circus, and we went there. She brought us to they have a whole floor that wraps circles around that's for basically for kids with all these carnival games. And then every half hour they do a circus show. So she left us there, and this was from daytime all the way to, like, the wee hours at night. And she left my two oldest siblings in charge of the twins, and they were taking turns. And my brother went to take a nap in the camper while he was watching the kids, or the twins. And so they got out, and they were running around the parking lot in their diapers at Circus Circus. And then the cops came, and then we're going all through the casino, rounding all of us up. And when they got all nine of us, you know, they searched everywhere for my mom, couldn't find her, and then kind of drove up and down the strip of Las Vegas, still no sign of her. So they brought us to juvie, to juvenile detention. So all nine of us, including two little twin, two-year-olds in diapers, and me, who was seven, you know, we spent the night in juvie, which was the best night of the whole summer, because they fed us, we had air conditioning, we had a cot to sleep on, and, yeah, then they finally found my mom, because they left a note on the camper and that we were at juvenile hall. And so she came and got us and basically took off. She was supposed to, I think, meet with the cops, you know, go to the police station the next day. And off we went, tore out of Las Vegas. Then I think it's maybe easiest if I just follow in my book of the titles of my chapters. It'll keep me in
sure.
in order.
However, which
and
way
then,
you want to do this, whatever makes it easier for you. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I started at third grade in San Francisco, and that was it was at a different school than my sister went to, and we went to Catholic school. And my mom is very, very Catholic, very religious, where she even goes to daily mass, not just every Sunday. So third grade, the class was already full where my sister went. So I ended up going to this school, this really like elite Catholic school in San Francisco for my fourth grade. And so my mother, you know, they have to, you know, give some families a break to get in. And so she would volunteer her time doing yard duty work to help out. And, you know, she was just really, really embarrassing at school because she would, like sell our some food stamps to make extra money, and then she'd be able to buy herself some clothes, and she wanted to fit in with all the rich mothers, and so she found this store called Fredericks of Hollywood, and that's where she did her shopping, which if you don't know, Fredericks of Hollywood is like a very sexy type of lingerie store, but they also mm-hmm. sell some clothes, but they're not very appropriate clothes, and that's how she showed up for yard duty every day. People, you know, like, of course we were made fun of because of that, and then she would watch me and would watch who I'd play with, and she'd be like, oh, you can't play with her, she's too fat, you're not going to be a fat slob like her, and oh, you're not going to play with another, with an N, you know, you're not going to have my daughter, you know, a black person. And you know, just things like that. Or that girl doesn't smile enough. I'm not going to have you moping around the house like her, you know. And so it's like she was there just, and then when I would talk back and say, I can play with whoever I want, because I did get, start to get kind of defiant. At an early age, she'd be like, oh, you want to make a bet? I'll go and pull you away by your hair. And so each summer, like I said, the rest of the kids would come, and, you know, just different adventures every summer. And and her birthday, my mom's birthday's in July. So my brother and I, he lives in Florida. We were the closest. He was only 2 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who would go, and we'd beg at restaurants for food together. And we were in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we went in this restaurant because it was like a walk-in diner. They didn't have a back door, like a fast food restaurant. And we got some baggies from the camper and, like, walked through really quick and grabbed food off all the leftovers, you know, off the tables and ran out. And, like, little bits of meat that were still left on a steak bone and, little bits of egg that was left on the plate and stuff. And so my brother was like, hey, did you see all that money on the table? And it happened to be my mother's birthday. So he's like, let's go in and get the money and we can get mom a present. And we always, you know, wanted to do good for my mom and, you know, and especially me, like, oh, maybe mom will like me now if I do something nice for her, do something good. And so we went and we bought her a little paper doll with the money. And she was like, where'd you get the money to buy this? And, you know, I said, oh, we got it off the tables in that restaurant. And she grab this big, fat, permanent magic marker and just knocked me on the pull-out bed and just was, like, kneeling on me and just scribbling all over my face, gouging the marker into my skin. And she did the same to my brother when I escaped. And so she put these black X's all over our faces that stayed there for a long time during that trip.
Yeah. Yeah.
To teach us not to steal. So that was her way to, you know, tell us, I'm not going to raise any thieving tramps.
But it's okay for you to go around. It's okay for you to go around taking food off of people's plates that are half, used and all that other stuff. Boy, it's a good thing I wasn't her kid. Go ahead.
My name is Teresa, but my mom never called me Teresa. So I was mostly a little girl, but a lot of times also my main name was Whore. You little whore. So those are the two names I grew up with mostly. You little tramp, you whore. So when I was in sixth grade, I was in class at this, I was in class at this school and the secretary comes in and says the principal wants to talk to me. And so I go down and in the principal's office, there's these two men. And from social services. And so they're asking me all these questions, about how life is at home and, how does my mother treat me and everything. And in every question they asked, I just lied. Said, yeah, everything's good. How does she discipline you? Does she ever hit you? And I'm like, no. Sometimes I get a spanking, so they said, well, let me see your arm. And I always, if there was anything on me, I always wore a sweater over my uniform. And I had these long claw marks from her fingernails of four lines going down my arm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they said, what's this? What's that from? And I lied and I said, oh, my cat scratched me. And I said, my cat hates being held. So I picked her up and she scratched me and ran off. And they were just like, well, are you sure there's nothing you want to tell us? And, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, everything's fine, really. And so they sent me back to class. And as I was heading back to class, we had these ramps at school instead of stairs. Mm-hmm. I'm going up the ramps and I'm thinking like, oh, my God, those guys are so stupid. Like, these look nothing like a cat scratch. They're so, they're so broad and wide. A cat scratch has these little fine, narrow lines. Like, those guys are the stupidest guys in the world. And then I was just going back and forth like, I should go tell them. I should say something. This is my chance. And I'm like, no, they'll try to get mom arrested. They're going to put mom in jail. And so I ended up going back to class, and that was that. And they had pulled my – so at this time, the twins were already in school. They were, I think, in first grade. And so they pulled Josh out of class, too, and not Jonas. Oh, that I'll get to that, too. And Josh also denied everything. Back to what I think Carolyn was saying, about the twins. So out of the twins, one looks just like my mother, and one looks just like me, my father. He looks like my father.
Right.
And so Jonas also was, you know, the little prince. And so the twins, you know, they were young still. So, you know, they didn't really have, like, the responsibility and or Josh or the abuse or anything yet. I say yet. But we were like, we never told anybody. And so we're just like, how do they know? You know, how would anybody know? Nobody knows. Like, I had some friends at school, but because I went to a really rich Catholic school, I didn't, you know, none of my friends lived anywhere near me. They're spread out all over the place. So they would be my friends at school, and they lived so far away, I wouldn't see them after school. And I didn't really have any friends around my neighborhood or anything. So we really didn't know how, except for we thought maybe because when we were in Utah and we toured the Mormon temple or the gift shop or whatever it is, the visitor center, we set up this thing called Family Home Evening where these missionaries would come over and play games and pray with us. And then my mom threw one of her major fits right in front of them. And we figured they probably saw how Mom treated me and Josh different than Jonas and Rachel and probably, you know, reported it. And that's why they probably came and just pulled us out of class. So we moved around in the city. My mom ended up getting a teacher's assistant job. It didn't pay much, but she finally had some money, and we were able to move out of the Tenderloin to like a nicer part of San Francisco. You know, still a very small apartment. So we went there, and then we ended up back downtown again. And the cable cars, they run the main street. They run on the street that goes downtown is Powell Street. So we had this small studio apartment again right on Powell Street where the cable cars run. And it was two blocks away from the Fairmont Hotel, which is a really nice, beautiful hotel in San Francisco. And the Fairmont then became my place to escape. And I knew the hotel just inside and out. And, you know, I would go explore there. I'd ride on the elevators. But they had these red velvet plush couches. And, you know, I would just go there and I'd sit on those couches and dream. And, you know, just dream of, and I think this is, you know, something with me that because I went to the school with the rich kids and I lived right near the Fairmont, I was able to kind of see how other people lived that were, you know, and it, you know, fired me up and pumped me up to say, like, this is what I want, you know. This is, so it kind of gave me something to strive for and to look forward to. And I was also in the school I went to was a French Catholic school. So we took French in the grammar school level. So I was in the French choir, and we also went and sang at all these like really elaborate parties and things in San Francisco where, you know, the rich people went. And so I got a taste of seeing this other way of life. And I wasn't just stuck in the Tenderloin or just stuck with, you know, with people that were poor like me. And I think it just having that, you know, it definitely gave me something to really shoot for. And that's what I would do at the Fairmont. I'd sit there and I'd sometimes, you know, be there, like if Mom just beat me and I ran out of the house, I would go to the Fairmont and just sit on those couches or chairs and cry and I'd people watch, and
I did the same thing. I'm sorry. It just popped out. I think a lot of us do that. We do people watch. You know, we learn things that way.
Yeah.
How other people live, you know, and this is how you got your dreams, by people watching and sitting on a plush couch, you know, something that the rich would have, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, at the Fairmont, no one ever kicked me out or asked me to leave or anything. And also, because I was so poor and, you know, I didn't have any nice clothes or anything and my hair was just always a mess. Not horribly, but, you know, I would see also, like, the way people were. And, you know, even at a young age, I could see, like, you know, how some people were just so rude and so mean, and the way they would look at me as a kid, like I had any control over what I wore or how I looked or, you know, and just curling up their upper lips and snarling at me. And yeah.
It's almost like it's your fault, like little dirty girl. How dare you? You know,
yeah.
How dare you come into my restaurant or whatever? They don't look to think or even stop to think that maybe there's a problem here. Okay?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And I do want to say one thing too. Going back, and then we're going to go to the panel. And going back to one thing that you had said, kids can come from disastrous homes. Disastrous homes, like your home was disastrous, mine was disastrous, a lot of us, okay? And they always stand up for the parent, okay? And the reason being is because they know what they've got, but they don't know what they're going to get, okay? And it's a very frightening thing. And you know what I'm talking about. So also, you're always still looking for the love from that parent. You said, and I did the same thing, and many of us do this. You would try to do things to please mommy, and look what would happen, okay? You'd get nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very painful, painful thing to go through, too. So you went through terrible emotional abuse, too. So you went through physical. Your mother would whip you. A lot of us have been whipped. But she would whip you. She would emotionally abuse you. She would down you. Put you in positions where at the age of seven, going back to that, at the age of seven, you were in charge of her and your twins and other, you know, it's ridiculous, you know, and that's terrible emotional and terrible neglect as well. So you are definitely in the right place, because this is how many of us have been brought up, if you want to call it that. And the people watching, that's why it flew out of me. I used to watch people to see what was right, what was wrong, what was good, what was bad. Sometimes I make bad decisions, and we do this. But let's go back to the panel and see what they have to say, okay?
Okay.
Pamela, I always start, usually always start at the top of the list. Pamela, go ahead, your turn.
Hi, Teresa. You're doing a great job, and we're really understanding how all this manifested and, you know, what was going on with your mother. But when were you able to get away from her? What age did you finally get out from under her abuse?
16. Yeah.
And, and then when did you start on your healing journey? When did you realize that you couldn't take this? You couldn't keep it down anymore, and you had to get something to for your respect.
Well, you mean other than when I was 16? Because that was part of it, definitely. But as far as coming out with my story,
right.
Well, that's just recent.
Kind of both. That's two questions. 16 to when you started getting on your healing, and then when you got on your healing.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange. I left her when I was 16, And then I buried it, and I didn't want anybody to know about it. And so that was my past, and I was going to move on, and I was going to be normal. Nobody was going to know anything about how poor I was or how crazy my mother was or how mean she was to me. And so I just left it behind. I didn't – when I left her, I left all that. And it's almost like, you know, seriously, other than these nasty letters she would send me, it was almost like it was forgotten. I went on with my life. I went on with my high school and my friends and then college and medical school. And, I mean, I felt like, you know, like my life is exactly how I want it. And I don't want to, I had a friend who was another doctor who I worked with, and I know she was going to therapy because of something from her childhood, and she would be crying and crying and, you know, reliving all this stuff. And I'm like, well, why would she want to do that? Like, I don't think about my stuff, and you know, I'm happy. I'm great. And it wasn't till I'd say about 4 or 5 years ago that, you know, I met someone. I was in a class, but I won, just, you know, kind of maybe it's this manifestation thing of the universe or something. But, and, you know, the guy, I told part of my story to the teacher, and he's like, oh, Teresa, you should really write a book. And anyway, just I'll cut to the chase here, but I started writing that book, and like the tears were just every word that would come from my pen, I would just be crying, and, you know, dropping all over my paper, and my pages would get soaking wet. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And just reliving everything. And and so this book, which has been about 4.5 years in the making, is, you know, when I resurfaced all this and brought it back up and purged out all those tears and finally am able to say something about it without fully breaking down and crying, because that's all. Whenever I'd want to try to tell anybody any little bits of my story, it would just be like me bawling. And I'm like, well, I can't do that. but I think I just got to this, I'm almost 55 now, and I just got to this age where, you know, I'm ready. And to be honest, I was so scared about how people would judge me and what they would think about me, and all the, like, oh, I wonder if she abuses her kids and all that, that, you know, that, yeah. I was thinking, like, all these judgmental people out there. But I got to the point where I'm like, you know what, I really don't care what any of them think or say or wonder. Or, and this book is not about them, and it's really not about me, although it was about me because it's been very cathartic and healing. But it's more about really like who this book might be able to help. And even if it's not just a kid who is in my situation or an adult, but maybe it's a teacher who reads it, who it opens their eyes, like, oh my gosh, I should treat my students a little bit better, or, oh, that poor kid that I'm not so nice to. And I think that's a big message of my book is, you know, what role the teachers play or can play in a child's life, because that might be the only bit of you know, kindness that this child might have.
So what made you realize there might be somebody else out there needing what you had? What made you realize that?
Well, it started with that one teacher who's telling me, like, Teresa, your story could really make a difference. I'm like, yeah, no, right. Like, who would care about this, or who would want to hear this? And when I was writing the book, I said, well, if this book can touch one person's life, because I know just as an adult now that there are other people that have gone through some things. When I was a kid, I thought I was the only one in the world. You know, nobody had a mother like mine. Nobody lived like I did. Everybody else had a normal family. I didn't know. But especially now that I've written the book, I've been getting a lot of messages. People Facebook message me or send me a message and give me, you know, their story. And I'm just, you know, my jaw just kind of drops because some of these people I know, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. And, you know, some are complete strangers that are opening up to me. And I'm like, oh, gosh, they're telling me this? Like, I can't believe it.
Wonderful. That's wonderful, though, because you see that's, you know, bringing forth more awareness and you're going back and forth, back and forth. And this helps you, too, because the more people that that do get in touch with you, you see how very much you are not alone, okay? And and any feelings that you have, you know, from the past, and certainly all of a sudden it does hit you one way or another. Now, you was through writing your book. When I wrote my book, I felt nothing. It was like a movie. I was watching some kid, that kid was me, going through all these things, all these different things, and I felt nothing. But I got a lot out of writing the book because I did receive so many different calls and so many emails, and it was, you know, publicized here and publicized. Now it's all over the world. It was in Japanese, all kinds of crap. They didn't even ask me. They just did it. And but anyway, the point is this is how we do, you know, spread the word by writing our books or singing our songs or writing our poetry. There's all different ways, you know, all different ways, blogging, going on our Facebook, especially the NASCA Facebook, and swapping stories back and forth. I've seen some of that at times. And, you know, so the word is definitely out there. It's getting out there more and more. Teresa, when I wrote my book, there was only one other book on Amazon of a memoir, in fact, of child abuse. That's it. And now, you go to Amazon, you look up child abuse or however, which way they do it, I haven't looked in a while. But it's flooded. The market now is flooded. So that means a lot of people, we're like the pioneers, okay? We started it. And now there's so many people that want to share their story. And then there's also so many people who want to share their story and can't quite yet do it. So you're doing a very brave thing tonight. And there's always reasons why people don't want to share their story. But it's because maybe it's going to ruin the family, okay? You don't want to mention certain family members. You don't want to do that. Or maybe even say, if you talk about this, I'm going to kill you. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
Out of fear factor. Yeah. There's so many, many reasons. But there's so many, many people out there yet to tell their story. What we need is for society to care. And this is something that you just brought up, okay? You sitting there. And you're dirty, your hair is unkept, and all this other stuff, and I can so identify with that. And people look at you like you're a scum or something. Excuse the word, but that's what they look at. They give you dirty looks, and they don't think, what is wrong? Where did this child come from? Why is this child like this? And now we have to get them to care, to really care. Enough to make even a phone call, whether, you know, to CPS or to the 1-800 for a child number that we have and we use, and they're on our cars, a 1-800 for a child, so that children don't walk around and go through the things like you went through, I went through, all of us on this panel went through, okay? And we can't stop child abuse. But, you know, it's more than one kid. I know what you're saying. But I know that there are many people that we do reach. I get a lot of emails. And I know that we reach a lot of people. And so what you're doing is a very brave and a very wonderful thing tonight. Thank you for that, Pamela. Let me go down to Bill, and then we'll go to Darlene. Okay, Bill, do you have a question or you want to make a comment or something to what you've heard so far?
Well, I have a lot of empathy for all the situations that she's describing. I know I ate off of scrap plates, not in childhood, but in adulthood, because I was so poor in adulthood. and I frequently did it as a waiter, you know, And I would just, I didn't care. I wanted to eat well, so I ate off of the remains of people's plates when they came back to the, towards the dishwasher. But anyway, you know, when we refer to getting on your healing journey, we're not referring to the last time you encountered abuse. We're talking about, and I think you clarified this, years mm-hmm. later, you made a decision to do something about it. And in the interim, you were in denial, complete denial, that you had, you should do anything about it, that, you know, and you were in this place where you had convinced yourself that to tell your story would be wrong, and it's just the opposite. So as you began to talk to other people and write your books, especially several years ago, that would be the beginning of your healing journey. And I want people out there to understand that, you know,
yeah.
it's very common to go literally decades between the time the abuse stops and that whatever that is, and it's commonly in a person's 40s or later, can be easily, that they get on their healing journey. And that would mean talking to a counselor. That would mean having a life coach. That would mean participating fully at NASCA, which, of course, this is one of the ways to, as Carol said, to express yourself with your story, telling it on a radio show. Now, this show, mm-hmm. of course, is being recorded. It belongs to you. So we would love for you to put it, the link to it on your Facebook page, maybe on your book page, wherever you want. It's your story and your show, so we want to make sure you understand that. And it will stay in our archives forever and ever, along with the nearly 3,000 other shows that are there. And we're just delighted to have you and include you as a member of the NASCA family. So thank you so much, Teresa, for your testimony tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. We're really thrilled to have you here. And you're doing so well. You really are. And you were a kid that was bounced around too much, you know, and like all of us, you know, hit, smacked. All the stuff that you went through and being hungry and then having to take charge at such an early age, many of us go through that experience where we have to become like the mother when the mother is mm-hmm. laying down, you know what I'm saying? And at a very early age. And there's just so much that we can identify, and I'm identifying with you left and right. And so I can understand that. Yes, I can, absolutely. Let me bring on Darlene. She may have some questions. Her mic is already open. Darlene, is there something you want to say? Go ahead.
I got a lot to say.
I know you do, by God. Go ahead.
Okay, I want to thank Bill for having this, you know, this podium here, you know, we can express ourselves. And I want to thank all the people like you, Carol, that come and make sure it gets off and going, everybody that's got their hands in doing it, get it all come together. And I want to thank Teresa for coming in, being brave and telling her story. And also, there's something else in the book that I haven't heard her mention. She might have when I stepped out of the room. But whenever... Wasn't it your story where you remember when you were leaving that your dad had tears in his eyes and stuff? He didn't want y'all mm-hmm. to go?
Yeah.
And there was no excuse for your mom doing that except for pure meanness.
What's that?
I guess her reason for going is pure meanness, wasn't it, or something?
Did you say meanness?
Was your dad... Yes, pure meanness.
Well, I mean, really, now, so I came to a lot of understanding also by writing the book. And really, now what I understand is she was running away from a bad marriage. So she, you know, she was obviously a victim of child abuse herself, and so was her mother. And so she was running away from a bad marriage is the reason why she took us.
Yes.
I mean,
we had a horrible upbringing too, but you know, we stopped it. They could have, if they really wanted to, they could have stopped it. Because when you know how bad it feels
when you were a kid to be treated that way, why would you want to do that to somebody else, especially your own kids? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I thought about what Carol said a while ago about the healing. You know, it's always going to be there. We never really get over 100%. But one thing to note about, think about all the people who feel sorry for all these kids that's abused, right? But then mm-hmm. when we're adults, they kind of shake us off and don't want to listen. They want to mm-hmm. do something about child abuse when they see the kid doing that. But when a person that's been through that tries to voice it, oh, why don't you just get over it? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They need to open up more their eyes even more and try to help instead of being so judgmental, you know? That's one mm-hmm. thing that society has a problem with. They claim they want to do away with child abuse, but they're not willing to listen to the stories where we can try to get together and help one another.
Yeah.
So that's, mm-hmm. I guess that's good all point. I got to say. I said a mouthful, okay?
That's fine. True. You did well. And that's a good point. Again, it's society. How can people, not just with children, if someone's laying down on the street, okay, I've actually seen someone step over them, you know, instead of trying to see uh-huh. what's wrong with the person, you know, or calling 911, they actually walk around them or step over them. I saw that at a train station some years ago. I couldn't believe it. And I called 911. I got the police there. But the point is this, as long as society is in the place where they're at now even after with many stories being told, don't think that we're not helping, though, because we have a big following of people all over the world that are starting to talk. Look at Hollywood. I don't particularly like Hollywood right now. We won't talk about that. But Hollywood, they have their own people, and they have their own foundations for the kids that were abused while they're, you know, if you do this, you'll get a better part, okay, in the show, on TV or whatever, in the movie. And so,
yeah, I can raise you up. You do this, and then you get this big part, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly they have, yeah. Uh-huh. I can mention this because Friends, I don't know if anyone ever watched that sitcom for a while, Friends.
Mm-hmm.
He, yes. David, what's his name? David, well, I can't remember his last name. Sort of the B. Brennan or something like that. He had a girlfriend who had been terribly abused, and I was going to try and get him to come on the show. But he made it very clear that his foundation that he had started was just for Hollywood, and that's a shame, okay? Because it's not just Hollywood. It is everywhere. It's everywhere. However, I am glad that he has that foundation for, you know, a lot of people in Hollywood because they need it too. But, yeah, I want to continue on here. You know, thank you, Darlene.
And I want to say she's very brave.
Yes, she is. Mm. You are very, very brave.
Thank
you. You were very brave when you were a child. Yeah, when you were a child. And you had to take on those terrible parts of an adult. I mean, that's terrible. I can't get over it. 7 years old doing what you did. And then also, too, all the things that you kids went through, you know, trying just to eat, to go in the garbage pails, the bins, and all that other stuff. I saw that once before, and I took one of those kids into my house and with the parents' permission and kept that person. He went and joined the service. He was with me for a while, and he turned out fine. But, you know, it's a terrible thing, you know, for children to have to go through that, a terrible thing. So, but anyway, all right, now today it's already, 9:17, I think, 9:17. I want to ask you something. You said that you were on your own when you were 16, right?
No, I wasn't on my own. That's just when I left my mother.
What did you do at the age of you left your mother?
Yeah.
Okay, where did you go?
What happened was, just like a few more like abuse things, where my mom, cause we lived on Powell Street where a lot of the tourists were, pretty busy area near Chinatown. So she's also thrown me out on the streets naked, like pulls me out of the bathtub, throwing me on the street naked, even like at the age of 12 and 13 when I'm an adolescent in puberty. But so when I graduated from eighth grade in 81, we moved to Louisiana. And there, my mother was in the hospital. She was diagnosed with some brain tumors and surgeries and blah, blah, blah. So I was at home taking care of the twins who were then in fifth grade for a while until someone at the church found out. And then they, you know, the priest asked the parishioners who can take the kids. And so I went and stayed with this one family. The twins were passed around from families and then ended up in foster care while my mom went through rehab and everything, rehab after the surgery. And then when I went back home, the family who I stayed with, they came and witnessed some of the abuse. And when and the mother just kept questioning things. And the next time I was at their house, the mother said, "Hey, we know this is going on. You have two choices. Either you call your father in Florida and see if you can go live with him, or I'm going to take you from your mother and you're going to stay with me." And so basically I called my dad and, you know, I told him if he doesn't take me, then this other lady, this person's going to take me. And I'm like, I don't know if mom's going to go to jail or what's going to happen. And so he said he would take me. And, you know, was talking about, like, getting me in to be a junior in the high school there. And I had gone to Catholic school all my life. And he said he couldn't afford the Catholic high school there. So I wrote a letter to the Monsignor at the Catholic school in Florida and asked if he could give me a discounted tuition if I could pay my own way and finish high school there. And so he called and he's like, not only I did have to pay tuition. I had to work right when I got to Jacksonville so I could pay for my high school. But he's like, I'm going to put you in advanced English because of that letter you wrote and blah, blah, blah. I didn't tell him there was abuse. I just said, I'm moving there to live with my dad and he can't afford it, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So that is, that's how I ended up. Then when I was 16, I went to Jacksonville and lived with my dad. And my one brother, John Eric, was the only one left at home. And then he moved out because he's 2 years older than me. And then I was there for another year. I also told my dad, you know, what was happening because Josh was also getting abused then. And he sent for Josh. Josh came to Jacksonville, but because there's so many rules at that house and with my stepmother and everything, Josh didn't want to stay. He wanted to go back home to Louisiana because he had so much freedom. And yeah, another part, my mom, back at the Fairmont in San Francisco, I had to steal toilet paper, and it was the only way she would let me use any toilet paper in the house is if I stole it from the Fairmont, because she says, I'm not spending my money on toilet paper. So I had to, for all these years, the only way that we had toilet paper was from what I took from the Fairmont. Yeah, but I was brave on the streets in San Francisco, but I was scared to death at home.
So you're a doctor now.
I understand that. I get that. She just said something here that's very important. You were scared at home, and yet you felt more at home on the streets. I understand that. A lot of us have been in that position. Yes.
Yeah.
That's because home is so bad. That's exactly right. So you've told quite a story here tonight, lady. Let me tell you something. And, so now today, though, let's speak about today because we don't have that much time left. Go ahead, honey. Tell us about today, what you're doing.
Just my life?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're married, you have children, and you're...
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So I'm married. This makes 25 years for us. And I have three daughters. Oldest one is now in college and two in high school. And I love our town in Benicia, this awesome little town in California. things are good. I'm a podiatrist.
I am so happy for you because, you know, a lot of times, I'm not saying that people don't have good endings because there are some that do, but I think if you were to take look at it all, if we could gather all the people that we've had on this show, oh my God, there's probably not too many that have such a good ending as you do because you're happy, you're a doctor, you're a foot doctor, and I could use you right now. I told you that on the phone the other day. And, you have beautiful children that you're proud of. They come from a good home. And I just want to reference a little something here that you had said before, go back a little bit, because there are 70% of us that do not abuse our children, and there are 30% of us that do, okay?
Wow.
And so that's with the sexual. But with the physical, a lot of times that number is higher because for some reason, because of all the terrible beatings and stuff, we tend to have that anger because we have so much anger and rage inside of us. Did you not have anger and rage inside of you? And did you ever turn to alcohol and drugs? Did you ever do that?
Well, I'd say like in college, I did my share of experimenting with drugs a little, but I would never say like I was an addict or had anything too out of control.
That's good.
And I think for me, what really helped, or because I come from a big family and we're, me and my siblings are all very close, and all of us, we'd be like, you know, Mom would talk about how hateful her mother is, and we'd all be like, how can she not see that she's doing the same thing to us, you know? So just knowing that, like, and always saying that, like, how can you talk about your mother when you're doing the same thing? And always keeping that in mind, like, you would never want to do anything like that to your own kids. And, you know, I can't wait to have my kids. I'll never be like that, ever.
That's wonderful.
And it's just
that's
a story, you know, like, you tell yourself growing up, like, always, like, I'll never be like her, ever.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have a therapist that you went to at any time in your life, or did you just be able to figure it out on your own? Did you say no?
No, I didn't. No.
Well, you know what? You've done fine. You've done fine. Look at you today, okay? You've written a book. It's called Wildflower, A Tale of Transcendence, and that's what it says here. And I can't wait to read that book. And, you told a wonderful story. You did a really fine job tonight, Teresa. You really did a fine job. And there was a tremendous amount of abuse that you had to endure. And kudos to you that it didn't, you know, make you a very nasty, mean person or whatever. Instead, you learned from what you went through. Instead of absorbing it and becoming the type of person of the family that you came from, instead you were able to turn it around. You're the one that broke the cycle. That's exactly what you did. You broke the cycle. And good for you. You know, I'm very proud of you. We all are. And I'm just so thankful that you came on. Yes. And you should be proud of yourself, too, because it would have been easy to turn out to be a nasty person and all this other stuff. And yet you were able to turn out to be a good person and also a foot doctor. And you've got your head together. Wow. I'm impressed. I really am. So I'm just going to go down the panel here. You bet, honey. I'm going to go down the panel here. Everybody can say goodnight, and then by that time, it'll be time for the show to end. Okay, Pamela, maybe you'd like to say goodnight quickly.
Yeah,
Thank you for coming on, Teresa. I want to say good night, and I'm so proud of you for going, for surviving and making it all the way through high school and college. And I'm just wondering how you made it. Who paid for your college if you were so poor?
Oh, I did. Yeah, so I worked two jobs to pay for high school, and I worked basically two jobs to pay for college. Plus, I got a Pell Grant, so I got a couple grants that helped with college, my undergrad. But I was a bartender. I started a hostess and waitress and bartending, and then during the day after class, I worked in the biology lab. So I kind of did it all.
Yes, you did. And we're so proud of you. So, so, so proud of you. Let's go down to Bill. I'm sure he wants to say good night. Oops. Open up your mic, glass tonight.
No, it's already open.
Go ahead.
I also want to congratulate you on your successes and, you know, remind you that this thing we call recovery, you know, continues and your life has its ups and downs during that time, but you never have to go back to the way it was before. You won't forget it, just as you reminded yourself tonight in order to tell your story. But it won't have the impact on you from this point forward, no matter what happens in your life. So congratulations. Thank you for your giving us your story. And we welcome you, of course, to the NASCA family. God bless.
Thank you.
God
bless.
You
thank
you. And Darlene, you'd like to say good night, honey.
Good night, and thank you for coming. I really admire you a lot, and you could tell I started reading on your book.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to prepare myself for today.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for that, Darlene. Sure. Yeah. And, Peter, you came on quite late, so I can't bring you on now. But anyway, listen to the archives. This is quite a story. And we're all very so, so proud of her. This is one strong girl because she had a rough start, you bet. And she was able to keep herself together. She didn't really get into drugs and alcohol or anything else or cutting or anything else that we know of or anything. And today she's a happily married lady. And she has beautiful children, and I'm just so proud of her, as is NASCA. You can come on anytime you want, by the way. I just want you to know that. And listen to any show. Look at the front page of NASCA, okay? Look at the front page of NASCA when you have time, and you'll see that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday are listed, and it gives you an idea of who's going to be on, okay? And Monday, Wednesdays, and Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, people tell their story, okay? So, and then Tuesdays and Thursdays, we have other people. What are you trying to say, Pamela? Go ahead.
This is Darlene. I'm trying to say.
Oh, it's Darlene. They both have a little twang. Go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There's also the support groups on the Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays.
Okay.
Let's resume.
How to get there is on the front page.
Okay.
Yeah, all the information you need. Yeah, that's a good point. All the information you need is on the front page, including what she's speaking about, what Darlene's speaking about. So there are other groups, too, that you can become involved with, okay? So you're never alone.
Perfect. Thank you.
And I have to wrap the show up now. So thank you so much for coming on. And please do come on. You can be one of the panelists, okay?
Perfect. Okay. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on. Good night and God bless. God bless everybody.
Good night.
Good night now.
God bless. Okay. Bye-bye.
God bless. Bye-bye. Everybody can hang up now. There we go. There's more.